Welcome to Path to CitusCon, the podcast for developers who love Postgres, where we discuss the human side of open source databases, Postgres, and the many PG extensions. I want to say thank you to the team at Microsoft for sponsoring this community conversation. And I'm Claire Giordano.
And I'm Pino De Candia. Today's topic is becoming an expert at using PostgreSQL.
And it is my pleasure to introduce Chris Ellis today. Chris is head of engineering at NextTeam, which is based in London in the UK. And Chris has been working with Postgres for 18 years. I think you first started with Postgres 8. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, about that, I think.
And Chris is a regular on the Postgres conference circuit. That's actually how I first met him. And he's also involved in organizing some of the Postgres community conferences these days. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you much. It's great to be here, and thanks for the invite. And really excited and interested.
I am too. All right, so let's dive in. We have so many questions about how you built up your expertise in Postgres as a user, and then what made you get involved in the Postgres community. But I really want to start with how you became more and more expert over the years at using Postgres and taking advantage of its capabilities. And before we do that, let me just ask a basic question. Like, what is it that you do at NextTeam? And how is Postgres part of that?
Yeah, so NextTeam is kind of sort of a bit of a general consultancy that me and a couple of friends set up. And kind of like bit of it is the idea being we're kind of like a full product stack to go and build apps for people. But the other kind of side of what we kind of do is just more general kind of consultancy. So we've got a number of kind of small clients I do Postgres support and consultancy work for. And then kind of another stream is more on the kind of building our own kind of apps ourselves. So we have a platform called Makuso, which is a kind of simple management app that we build, and that's all using Postgres as its back end under the hood. So yeah, we kind of like all different three different angles of using it on different projects across the years, and then our own projects we build, as well as supporting other people from using it.
Awesome. So let's step back further. Like, let's go to your origin story. People have given me so much feedback that they're always fascinated about how do people get their start, or why Postgres, or why open source. So how did you get started as a developer?
Yeah, so I mean, a large element of it is kind of a bit of like, I always had computers around me as a kid, and always being quite curious and fiddling with stuff. So I kind of probably started programming really in, like, I think QBasic on MS-DOS on a 486 back in the mid to early 90s when I was kind of like 5 or 6 type thing, just playing around and, you know, that kind of curiosity. And I guess helped by having, you know, my parents who kind of both have kind of scientific backgrounds and worked in kind of IT as well, that, you know, always had kind of like access to kind of them to kind of push me and nudge me a little bit. And I was always kind of like busy building stuff and fiddling with things from a very early age, and that kind of like curiosity and that kind of stuff. And kind of over the years, I can then segue into like Visual Basic, really, as you do. And I kind of properly started using Linux and a lot of that kind of stuff kind of when I was around 12 at kind of what we call secondary school here in the UK. And that kind of piqued my curiosity a lot more. You know, I was running DNS servers when I was 12 and stuff like that, and getting cease and desist letters from our ISP because we used the internet too much. And this is the days of 56k dial-up and things like that. And then kind of segued into Perl, wrote a few things with Perl against like MySQL. And then, yeah, I'm not entirely sure really where the like, oh, you should go and try Postgres came from, but it was sort of like, to some extent, an element of, oh, it's more free and better than MySQL, you should go and try and play with it. So I did, and that was probably when I was like, say, 17-ish, I think. And I kind of pretty much never looked back. You know, it's one of those things I just started playing with, and then I built some little apps when I was at university with it. At the same kind of time, I kind of, whilst at university, I also worked as like a professional programmer. So I actually studied electronic engineering rather than computer science, although a couple of my close friends at university were in computer science. So it was a very interesting perspective, like working as an actual paid programmer in my university holidays. And then like chatting to my friends at university about like they're learning the theory, and then I was already kind of practicing kind of the real world programming to some extent, right from that kind of age. So it was kind of an interesting world of like, I'd go and spend a term at university learning like in electronics, like low level circuit type stuff. And then I'd go spend the kind of like Christmas holidays in April, and like April break and summer break, kind of actually coding on real world stuff in Java. I kind of taught myself Java in 2 weeks of the kind of that first job. And that was kind of like how I kind of got properly started as a developer at that point. And kind of it's been my job really ever since. And so it's one of those things where it's as much a kind of hobby and a passion as it is a job. But yeah, so that's kind of like how it all really sort of started. And bits of it are kind of by accident. Bits of it are like my mom saying, oh, you've got 6 months, go and get yourself a job before you go to university and stuff like that.
A wonderful origin story. I have two follow-up questions, if you don't mind.
For
someone who started so early as a developer and hosting managing your own Linux servers, who did you rely on when you had questions? Was it your parents, friends, siblings? Who'd you go to?
Yeah, I mean, I think also back then, the magazines were a bigger thing than they are now, right? So I always, they're probably still my parents' loft, but like a stack of Linux Format and Linux User and Developer magazines that kind of used to very religiously buy. And, you know, back in that era, like the big distro was Mandrake Linux / then got renamed Mandriva. And they kind of got a lot of their early users by sponsoring kind of magazines and putting a CD on the magazines and stuff like that. And so it was a large element of those kind of publications. And I guess kind of look sort of like the internet is a thing at that point. Also like man pages, right? I mean, so much you could just, you know, everybody forgets you can just type man and then the program you're playing with. And there's actually quite a good documentation, especially for say for like bind DNS servers. The kind of man pages are actually pretty good. And then also, I guess, as well, you know, I mean, my dad was never really a big, like, Linux user or anything. I mean, he used to run the Novell groupware user group. So he was much more of a Novell network person. And we did, at one point, have a Novell server in the house that we were playing with, me and him set up and things like that. So it was an element of, I guess, you know, like, kind of, like, learning from peers and that kind of stuff, like, hands-on, as well as also just going and doing my own research and looking stuff up and reading kind of different short form data sources, really.
That's fantastic. My second question really is just a follow-up on this idea of getting started on user groups or question boards, mailing lists early on, and developing that muscle of talking to the community.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember my first ever email to the Postgres mailing list, which is kind of at my first job after I finished university. And I mean, I'd been subscribed and reading the list probably for a few years at that point, right? And we were kind of deploying a new server. It was actually kind of a full-on search engine for our website. And so one of the big drivers had been, you know, well, we can spend a bit more money on the hardware, have something decent. And, you know, so we bought these IBM servers because that was an IBM shop. And performance wasn't quite as we expected. And my first kind of big post asking for help was like, we've got this kind of hardware. I can't get my benchmarks are showing like this absolutely disastrous number. This doesn't seem to make much sense. You know, am I doing something completely stupid here or what? And I think I had a really great reply from a guy called Scott Marlowe, I think it was, which was call IBM and tell them to pick up your boat anchors. And, you know, as well as some practical advice, but it was a great kind of example of, you can kind of actually just sit and kind of consume stuff off mailing lists for quite a long time. And you don't feel like you have to join a mailing list just to ask a question or just to interact, right? You can use a mailing list just as an information and knowledge source. And I think the Postgres hackers list is a great example of that, where it's an extremely high volume list. So you can't really read out anything. But if you want to find some interesting nitty gritty about low level stuff in Postgres, it's pretty much like one of the better places to go if you can sit and wade through reams and reams of like low level arguments about stuff. And that's definitely, you know, a place where I've learned a lot over the years has been kind of consuming those lists more so than say asking questions or answering questions on them.
Rob Treat just linked to your first thread on the Postgres mailing list. So it's in the it'll be in the show notes as a piece of history. Okay, so I want to make sure we don't scare anybody off. For people who are listening to this and did not start working with code at the age of 5 or 6, right? Or not running DNS servers, did you say at the age of 12? Like you're a combination of university trained, but even more so self-taught, right?
And with this definitely. Curiosity. I mean, so I probably consider myself more self-taught, but.
Well, so here's the question. Those friends of yours who had more traditional training in university, right? And weren't self-taught from the age of 5 and with parents nudging them in the background. Have they thrived in the tech world? Like, are there other paths into the tech world? Do you have to start at the age of 5?
No. I think also, I mean, like, especially my first job, which was local government, it was loads of people there who actually hadn't been to university at all. And I do think one of the things the tech industry at times forgets about is that actually there are plenty of people who are very capable programmers and who are very good developers who don't have a degree and especially don't have a computer science degree. I mean, I don't have a computer science degree. And I kind of actually partially think like pretty much everything I do day to day is all self-taught and none of it was actually really from my university side. I think one of the interesting kind of caveats and sides I would say is that people I tend to find who do computer science degrees don't lack all of the qualities of what is engineering. And I think the ability to take kind of your knowledge and skills and apply it practically is kind of an interesting side where people actually who maybe don't have those kind of very straight computer science degrees can actually be better at applying how to go and use stuff and how to go and do stuff. And I'm probably a fairly good example of that in like a lot of my talks and a lot of like how I understand and internalize bits of Postgres is probably very different to somebody who has like a mathematics degree or an actual, say, computer science degree, where I think they're much more likely to talk about like the theory and stuff going on behind it and like things like sets and all that kind of stuff. Whereas I'm much more likely to approach it and think about it from that, well, this is something I can use to do that, and I can also get it to do this, this, and this. And it's a little bit like, you know, for a bit of an analogy, right? If you've got a toolbox of parts, and I think Postgres is kind of really good at having lots and lots of tools in that box compared to different other platforms. And, you know, knowing which ones to use is kind of both you need to know what's in the box and also how to go and use that tool.
Okay, so that's a perfect point to talk a little bit more about how you got involved in Postgres. So you mentioned that mailing list post, but I imagine there's more to the story than that. How did you get involved with this toolbox of parts?
Yeah, so I think, again, a lot of it comes back to that curiosity and having problems to solve and needing to go and kind of solve them. I remember I was also quite lucky probably in that my kind of first job that my peers who worked there had kind of probably instilled quite good like architectural processes. So like before we started projects, we used to kind of think about data modeling and application architecture and kind of, you know, spend say a few days writing up a little bit of a, you know, here's how we're going to approach this kind of project and that kind of stuff. And I think it's to some extent, with the success of Agile, has kind of eroded some of those kind of activities a bit too much. But that kind of like, well, okay, well, if we're going to go and like, we need to go install this data in this kind of place, then once you start breaking down what I need to do, then it's very easy to start seeing like where I can go and use things. So starting from that kind of basis of, well, you know, we want to store some data, but then as stuff kind of evolves, you get more difficult problems. And I think it's also a case of, right, you have to kind of try things and experiment and keep trying things. I think one of the big kind of misconceptions is that you could become an expert overnight. I don't think that's true. I mean, I don't think there's a point where you can ever say your learning is finished or complete, right? I think that's always one of the things that is fascinating, and especially if you've had those few interactions in the community as well, which is like, you go to like the Postgres conferences and there's people with knowledge of so many different parts of Postgres. And Postgres is probably a big enough code base that nobody can understand the whole thing in its entirety. And so you get people who are experts in the planner or how the storage works or that kind of stuff. And it's that, so it's always that concept that, you know, I can only ever be as, you know, there's always going to be somebody more knowledgeable than me, and there's always going to be somebody kind of less knowledgeable than me. So the way I was going to see it is like, there's always somebody I can teach, and there's always somebody that I can learn from. And so as elements of, like, you know, knowing that kind of stuff, go and kind of look around, and as the problems evolve and you understand new ways to go and do them, and it's that element of, like, if you don't keep practicing it, like, routinely, you're never going to become an expert at it. Very much like the analogies that are often used about, like, learning a musical instrument or playing a musical instrument. And then you just kind of pick off from those starting points. So, I mean, yeah, I think my first kind of interactions with the community were those kind of mailing lists. And I also kind of, at that similarish time, I actually went to my first Postgres conference, which was PGConf EU in Stuttgart in 2010. And that was, like, eye-opening. I remember my first Postgres talk I ever went to was Gianni Colli talking about functions. And his entire talk walked through building a chess AI effectively in Postgres functions. And the talk was much more of a way to kind of introduce people to functions and the actual advantages of all the stats tracking that kind of go on under the hood. And I think, to be honest, like, going to that event gave me so many things to go and do more research about, go and think about, that then kind of really accelerated my kind of starting point of getting into Postgres even deeper than I was. And that was kind of then probably around the time I kind of left working there and moved on to another company where I actually came in as the Postgres specialist. And that was kind of interesting in that that story, how it all happened, is kind of funny in many ways, but it's that kind of, like, concept as well, you know, going from being a general developer where, you know, I'd always done a bit of everything. So whilst I was in the development team, I actually built all the servers and was the sysadmin for the servers we had. I did lots of the back-end code. I even built bits of the front-end, worked very closely with a designer. So I've always been that kind of person that just goes across the whole kind of stack and just gets what done needed to be done. And then it was a bit strange to kind of go to a place and now you're the Postgres specialist. But, you know, and that was probably at the same kind of time that, like, Greg Smith had produced the book on, like, Postgres 9 performance, which was another kind of key tool for me. And I think one of the good things I really like about that book is it kind of explains all the different parts of systems you need to understand to be able to tune and improve performance. And that can be, you know, it's that how stuff links together is kind of probably easy to miss at times, and it's actually everything leveraging everything that's important.
Wow. I'm still, you've piled so many things on the stack. We could go in so many different directions.
Yeah.
I'm still stuck on the Gianni Colli talk in 2010 in, yes, Stuttgart. Just because, like, when you talk about building chess, you know, some kind of chess functions in Postgres to introduce people to functions, it just reminded me that you do this as well. A lot of the speakers at Postgres conferences, particularly when they're teaching something that is maybe more to beginners or newbies, they really make an effort to use fun examples or make the topic more approachable, even if it's a very complex topic under the covers. And so anyway, I can see how that might have hooked you.
Yeah, definitely right. And I think that's also, like, to be a good speaker, you have to make a talk memorable and entertaining. And, you know, to jump around a bit, like, the first ever talk I gave, like, the feedback there was made a dull topic even duller. And that was probably a bit of a changer in that, okay, I need to try and change my style here and actually think and kind of invest a bit more in how you actually approach selling the content and, you know, getting people to understand it by kind of, you know, if they don't feel engaged and entertained, then they're the worst talks to go to. And yeah, I mean, Gianni was definitely, like, a really great example of that. Boris is also really good at those kind of style of talks. Like, his talk on Jason from PGJ Nordic last year was such fun to listen to, and like a really good way of getting people to remember the kind of key points. And you know, like Gianni was probably only really trying to get across a couple of like fairly simple-ish features in Postgres, but did it in such a fun way. It also introduced you to different other avenues and things like that.
Chris, oh, that must have been some pretty tough feedback to receive, and fairly blunt. How did you take it? Did it make you want to just jump right back in, try again with a new talk, or did it set you back?
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously a bit later, and that was after my 2017 talk, and I'd done a fair number of talks in the past, and I think at that point I was probably mature enough to realize and accept the kind of feedback and criticism for what it was. As opposed to, I think it's very easy to just think, oh, I'm awful, I shouldn't keep trying, that kind of stuff. I think if I would have one message to anybody who has done one talk or is thinking about doing talks, it is like tough at times, and you just have to kind of keep putting yourself forward. Like, especially like, you know, just even getting selected, right? You know, that's a hurdle in itself. And if you don't keep putting yourself forward, you'll never get it, right? You've got to be in it to win it type thing. And yeah, it's really easy to give up, and sometimes having the motivation to keep going, you know, definitely times where I've thought, oh, I don't really have anything interesting to say and stuff like that. I also tend to limit myself in my talks to like use cases and practical things and what I've done, which probably means I don't have quite as much of a repertoire as, say, other speakers. But I kind of, that's my style, and I feel much more comfortable doing that, because I feel like it's a lot easier to be in complete control of the knowledge domain. And I think that's, for me, especially to manage like nerves of going on stage at times, I'm not really somebody who can remember a script and stuff. So I kind of just more have to need to use the slides to know, like, this is the order to go and talk in and lay the kind of bits out in the right order. I think also there's elements of, like, I remember I did a unconference, probably kind of like 2012-ish, I think, and I hadn't really prepared. I just thought, oh, you know, this is cool. I went along, and then it was like, oh, you know, I'll pitch a talk about Postgres. Completely unprepared, and it was a complete disaster. And somebody kind of afterwards said, a friend kind of said, yeah, you came across as a complete and utter hyperactive idiot. And that was then, like, you know, probably knocked me back a little bit, but also just made me realize that actually, if I'm going to do this, I just need to be a bit more prepared. I need to plan stuff and need to rehearse. And yeah, so I think it's more of a case of like, take the feedback and use it to improve kind of what you do, right? Like you would like writing code to some extent.
You are not the only person to tell a story about how your first conference talk had problems. Right. There are so many brilliant speakers today who talk about that first experience, that second experience. Like, I still cringe when I think of my first training session that I led at Sybase of all places, just dating myself. And I was teaching them things about SunOS. I don't even remember what, but they videotaped it. And when I saw the video afterwards and saw like how I was distracting the audience by the way I was moving around on stage in a really unnatural way because I'm so nervous. It's just, it made me cringe. And I just wanted to crawl into a hole. I felt so bad. And I think the maturity with which you talk about how you have to, you know, keep trying and you have to take that feedback and do more preparation and take it seriously in order to get better is really, really spot on. And anybody you look at that's good, it didn't just happen. They practiced, right?
Indeed, right. And I really can't express at times as well, like, just rehearse your talk beforehand is so important, right? Because especially if you get nervous as well, or it's like, especially the first couple of times I did my like IoT talk, which is the talk I've had like most success with. It was, you know, I probably rehearsed it for 3 or 4 days, or when me and a friend did a talk at Postgres London, you know, it actually doing it with two people is even harder and requires a bit more rehearsal and that kind of stuff. But we kind of just met up 3 or 4 times over the week beforehand and rehearsed the talk. And especially as I think was trying to hit quite a tight time slot for that one as well. And it just makes it so much easier though if you've done the kind of preparation. And I must admit, one of my concerns in PGDay Nordic this year was I was feeling a bit underprepared, but you know, actually it all went pretty well in the end.
Oh, it was great. Okay, we've segued into talks. We'll come back to your start in Postgres and open source in just a minute. I just want to share something about your talk that you gave in Nordic. I will pop slides. I think I have the slides. Yeah, I'll pop the slides into the chat in just a second. It was called Advantage Postgres.
Yeah.
So I did get a little distracted in the very beginning trying to think, is there a tennis connection to this? Is Chris a big tennis player? Like, where's he going? And but it was great because you shared a lot of your tips and knowledge across several different parts of Postgres about things in the toolbox.
Definitely right. And that's what I wanted it to be. And I've kind of tried to pitch the concept quite a few times, and it was kind of lucky it got accepted this time around. And it was also like a lot of the feedback I got from my IoT talk was, oh, this is actually just a really good run through of different features to use. So like my original kind of idea was, well, I can take a lot of the content from there and respin it and remodel it and then add stuff in. And yeah, it was very much meant to be like, here's a walkthrough of lots of different tips and tricks I've used over the years. And actually, like, some of the feedback from the audience, like, immediately after I came off stage, were like, there was a couple of people, it's like, oh my God, that's like a brain changer, right? Those things. And it's not necessarily at times that people don't know they exist. It's like knowing that you should go to use them as well. I mean, I've worked with so many architects and stuff that, I mean, I've worked with architects who even dislike people having foreign keys and things like that. And it, to some extent, just smacks of they've not really written any code for a long time. But also it's like, you know, there's so many powerful features and things you can do in Postgres. And if you kind of put the effort in to know they exist and kind of think about them, you can actually like leverage them to make your application much kind of stronger and more performant. And can be a massive advantage, and that's kind of really the angle I wanted to go at, was don't just treat the database through the eyes of an ORM, which is what a lot of people do. Or, you know, SQL's moved on an awful lot since like 1992, and like Marcus Winand's website Modern SQL is a great example of just that, and that's probably another good source I've learned stuff from over the years. And I met kind of Marcus, I think, back in like 2015 at PGConf EU and chatted to him a bit. And, you know, he was talking about like his kind of content and sites he'd been writing at that time. And then so I went and read them, and there's some really good information on there about all the different features of Postgres and just of SQL in general, and really good pointing out like what databases support what and things like that. And really great kind of sources. I mean, there's some of those people do really good content and kind of very valuable for learning what you can do.
So one of the, there are so many people who create all this different content. Is how does the fact that Postgres is open source play into that? How does the fact that Postgres is open source play into your work and your experience these last 18 years?
Well, I guess there's two elements to that. Like, I am kind of fairly invested into open source as like a political movement. So I do go out of my way to run Linux. I have been running Linux as like my only desktop since I was like 15, 16, and things like that. So there's that element of, I do deliberately try to only really use open source software. And I think that's also one of the other times, is like people always find it strange that I really know nothing about Oracle, and that's kind of pretty much entirely by choice. But so there's that element that's, you know, that it being open source is very important to me, as a, like, you know, political and ethical side. But also, like, being that kind of like curious person, it's a really great advantage to be able to like scratch your own itch and understand how that black box works. So like an interesting example of that was we had a fairly big stored procedure that was processing a lot of deletes. And after like 3 days, it was still running. And it's like, okay, this is a bit weird. And so started digging into things. And then, you know, dug through the source code to find the one comment in the source code that said, oh, we don't really expect anybody to hit this condition. Therefore, we're using a singly linked list. And it's like, ah, okay. So maybe I should try not to hit that condition in that particular instance. And so for me, that has been very interesting and useful over the years. As for, I mean, also like Linux, I've dug through Linux source code at times. And I remember investigating some problems with like Trim and XFS on NetApp and things. You know, the ability to like look into the code and actually understand what's going on was so valuable, especially to be able to prove to other people and other consultants, you know, the one thing people can't argue about is when you show them the line of code. But yeah, I mean, definitely I find the fact that Postgres is open source is like really advantageous for being able to increase your own understanding of it, because you can just go and read the planner code and read the executor code. You can also just dig through and understand like some of these little quirks and things like that, which you can't do in any other commercial setting.
Yeah, that ability to just look in and understand. What's interesting about what you just said when you were describing the stored procedure that was still running after 3 days is yep. that you made the comment, that's a bit weird. I'm going to dig into it. That those are almost not quite the exact words, in fact, not the exact words, but very similar to what Anders Freund told me the other day about his investigation
right.
To the etc/utils backdoor. Right? He's like, huh, that's weird. That shouldn't be happening. And then he just dug and he dug and he dug. And anyway, I am so thankful for his discovery.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a really interesting, and I mean, it's probably not really the first time this type of attack has been tried on the community. And I think also it's a really good demonstrator of what's often termed Linus's law, that, you know, that enough eyes will every bug is shallow type stuff. And I think the bigger discussion point here is probably more that were the right people looking? And I think probably not is the real answer. And yes, I mean, and Anders has kind of pointed out on Mastodon and stuff, like it took a lot of coincidences for me to spot it. But also if there was anybody kind of tenacious and curious enough to go and dig into it and find it and then unwrap it all, it was probably him. And yeah, it's kind of like one of those things where, to some extent, I think it's really easy for people to say it's luck that we spotted it. I mean, look at the number of backdoors that have been in, say, Cisco or Juniper for years and years that nobody knew about. And, you know, I think actually the key thing here is like bits of open source have actually kind of worked how they're meant to.
Yeah, I think he's been overwhelmed by the response. There's just so much appreciation and recognition, and I don't know. I think everybody in the Postgres community is kind of jazzed that, you know, a Postgres person who was investigating this 500 millisecond, you know, latency regression was the one to discover this.
Yeah, I mean, I loved somebody's take, which was, well, it's good. It's more interesting to see that Postgres devs are really serious about performance.
They are. And somebody else said, okay, I better make sure I don't slow down Postgres in any way. Otherwise, Andres is coming to get me. So it's been interesting. Okay, let's get back to you. Because, you know, obviously the Andres stuff is being covered in lots of other places and even podcasts. So let's stay focused.
Maybe I'll chime in about something Chris said. Or I really admire, and I didn't succeed as an engineer. I'm now an engineering manager, but I never succeeded in really boldly attacking all the layers, like investigating all the layers. It takes a certain amount of confidence, right, to go through layers of code, huge code bases. I mean, I guess going through a debugger, that can help because at least you have a path to follow, but sort of putting it all together, how do you encourage or train, or what advice do you have for developers about having that curiosity and that confidence about going and looking at in all layers of the stack, code bases that you didn't develop yourself, you're not actively working on possibly.
Indeed. I guess, well, there's two elements to it, right? I think you have to have the passion and curiosity to go and do that. And part of me would also say, like, if you're really not that interested in looking at it, then you're probably never going to become an expert in it, and maybe go and focus on something you do actually find genuinely interesting to you. You know, everybody's kind of slightly different in that regard. But I think also it's that it's really easy to just stay inside your little perceived box and not understand, like, how the layer below you works. And one of the things I do find a bit concerning is, like, with a lot of modern software architectures is we have so many levels of abstraction now that is it feasible for somebody to, like, really dig as much as they once could? And I'm not sure if, like, the answer is yes anymore, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing. But I think it's like, yeah, I mean, like, the first time I kind of, say, went and dug through some kernel code, it's like, I'm not, like, a C expert, and that's probably one of the reasons, like, I'm not really a code contributor to Postgres, is, like, my C skills are probably a bit lacking, and they're much more focused on embedded hardware than they are on the kind of, like, server software. But, you know, most code is kind of fairly readable, and actually one thing I think is really good about the Postgres code base is it's a really good shining example of well-written code. A lot of it's well commented. You know, it's actually quite easy to find yourself your way around. It's got a very good kind of strong internal architecture, and I think bits of that kind of come back to, like, in my kind of, like, electronics background, the first thing we always kind of do when we're designing a circuit is what you call a block diagram, right? You know, I know I need a power supply, I know I need this, I know I need that talking to that, and that's kind of how I try to approach software, is draw out those kind of black box little subsystems I need, and then kind of know what's going to talk to what, and then I can kind of expand my knowledge under each of them when I need to. And so, like, if you think about things like that, then it's a, well, I've got a database that's going to call and put stuff in a file, right? Okay, well, now I've got a very simple thing of, like, well, how does a file system work? And then go and dig through that. And like, in terms of, like, Linux knowledge, there's a great book by somebody called Robert Love, which just goes through really simply expanding out on all of the fundamentals of the kernel. Probably one of the best written books I've ever come across of, like, explaining how Linux works.
What's it called again?
Something like Linux Explained or something like that, I think, or Understanding Linux. I shall double check my bookshelves later on.
Okay. And what's the author's name again?
A guy called Robert Love. He used to work at, I think he works at Google these days, but back then he worked for Novell after they acquired SUSE.
Okay, cool.
Maybe I'll ask, I don't want to get into a whole segue about AI, but it's relevant here in that I wonder if it makes this kind of investigation more accessible with the copilots helping to understand code bases. Do you have any thoughts on that? Have you used AI to understand, you know, to help your debugging or to help your understanding of code bases?
Yeah, it's interesting because I must admit I'm a bit of a skeptic on it at times. And we have been using it recently on one project to summarize telephone transcripts, and I've been quite surprised at how good it is for that kind of use case. In terms of, like, looking through code, something that's able to, like, chain and look up, like, you know, this function, this is calling this function, jump me to that source code, is probably, like, the thing I really value the most. And some languages, that's a lot harder. And, you know, a good text editor is great for that kind of stuff. I mean, being a Java person, like, for me, Eclipse was always kind of incredible at that kind of stuff. Just press F3 and you kind of jump to the source of what you're calling. And yeah, I've not really tried like CodePilot for some of that stuff. I think my concern would be if you ask it to try and summarize things, whether it's going to then make too much of almost a decision for you, where it's going to kind of try to explain things. And one of the things I have seen a bit too much is, like, hallucinations. Like, my boss quite likes using Gemini or whatever it is. And like, he goes, oh, well, you know, does Postgres have a way to do this? And then it's like, oh, no, I'll ask Gemini. And then I spend the next half an hour explaining to him that it's just hallucinated the wrong answer to you. So I think, you know, there's definitely some improvements all these tools need. And I think if they were better at citing their sources and stuff like that, then potentially I might value them a bit more.
So we might have to wait a little bit longer, but yeah, thanks for your answer.
I think what worries me is someone like you, Chris, can see that perhaps something is off in one of these answers from an AI system, and because you have become more expert, but it might seem very plausible to someone else. So recognizing hallucinations is challenging, I think.
I think I don't see Chris on stage anymore. He must have gotten disconnected.
Okay, well, we will wait for him to come back. In the meantime, those of you who are on the chat, if you want to pop in questions that Pino or I can talk about. Rob is perfect. Now is a good time to remind people about the Pozette CFP. So those of you who listen to this podcast live here today, as well as we're going to publish it in a couple of days on Friday. And so there'll be a 2.5-day window from when it first gets published from Friday midday Pacific time until Sunday night at 11:59 p.m. PDT, Pacific Daylight Time, and that's on Sunday, April 7th. The CFP, the call for proposals, is going to be still open. And so you'll have a chance to submit talk proposals. So Pozette, an event for Postgres, is a third annual virtual event, which is organized by the team here at Microsoft. But, you know, last year, I think more than 60% of the speakers were from outside Microsoft. Many people from within the Postgres community, people who were contributors, community members, as well as like Azure Database for Postgres customers and Citus open source users, like people from a whole bunch of different circles all came together had these wonderful virtual talks recorded. So the CFP is open. And I encourage anyone, first-time speakers, as well as super experienced, and everyone in between, to submit. What have I missed? I think Chris is back.
I think Discord decided to have a moment.
Well, we decided to talk about the CFP for Pozette while you were gone, because we're in that hockey stick of the last couple of days that the call for talk proposals is open. And yes. People are curious about whether you submitted a talk proposal to Pozette. Sometimes people don't want to reveal that until after they've been accepted or rejected.
I have submitted two, and I have two more I want to submit as well.
Awesome. Yeah, there's a limit of four.
Yes, I know. So,
got it. Well, I think that would be great. I know the talk selection team would love to consider your proposals, Chris, because I'm on it. So people also had questions about your lightning talk that you just gave at PG Day Paris, which was titled Electric Elephants. I am literally holding one in my hands, and I'm turning it on right now because it's just so cool. Let's just do a quick segue on that.
Sure. So I guess for the people who are kind of listening and listening later, I basically designed some light up LED badges in the shape of an elephant. Which I've given a few out to people at both PG Day UK last year and at various other events. And I did a very brief lightning talk on kind of where they came from, why I did it, and how I went about building them and that kind of stuff. They were kind of very much a bit of a because you can type thing, inspired by a kind of cat design I kind of did based off of an Art Deco glass pendant, and I thought, you know, the color scheme worked well with PCBs and I can do some lights on it, and then that it kind of all spiraled a little bit out of that into then designing some in the shape of an elephant for kind of my love of Postgres, really, and then all kind of designed in kind of KiCad, so it's all open source, and then the software is all Arduino, and it actually runs a little tiny state machine inside, so you can actually kind of program the patterns effectively. And then I even went as far as building a full online emulator and editor.
It was really fun to watch. Lightning talks are just such an opportunity to be creative. You only get 5 minutes and then you get kicked off the stage. So you have to really hone and focus on, okay, what can I share in 5 minutes that people in the audience will enjoy or will benefit from. And yours was definitely in the enjoy category. I think people
Yeah, I think it's also a great way to get slightly different content. And, you know, I think, especially at some of the events, right, it can, you know, it is nice to see the other kind of like random bits going on in the community and stuff like that. So I thought it was a really great opportunity. And I thought it was quite, it was good of the organizers for kind of picking some slightly varied and slightly, you know, kind of brave topic titles as well. And I thought all the lightning talks were really good. And I thought it was a real great way to inject some energy after lunch. And I definitely would like to try and persuade us to do it at PG Day UK this year. And I think we're also talking about for PG Conf EU potentially having two kind of lightning slots and actually having a call for papers for it. So I think that would be some kind of cool steps forward. And I think they're a very interesting and powerful kind of type of talk, and probably not enough of them get done at times.
Yeah. And I think when the lightning talk CFP is a piece of paper that people have to like rush to during the conference, and they don't know if they're going to make it or not. So I think there's just so many people who don't prepare a talk because there's no guarantee that they're going to get the slot. And so you end up with a very different set of speakers. So I loved having the CFP in advance. So people could submit, they could know in advance if they're accepted, they could plan their travel like accordingly, right? Because some people can only get the budget to go to a conference if they, then like, obviously a lot of attendees go to learn, but some people are in constrained economic environments and they it helps them get their budget if they have landed any kind of speaking slot. So, okay.
Definitely.
Well, thank you again for creating the Electric Elephants. I dropped the link to the lightning talks in the chat too, so if people want to go check it out.
Yeah, I mean, there is some more information on my blog as well. I think I link out for that. But
awesome. Yeah, I think from the schedule, there's a link to your slides, right?
Yep.
Okay, I'll get that in there too. All right, so right when you disappeared, I was asking whether you want to talk about your learning style. You had told me that you are a slow reader. And obviously that yes. has not inhibited your ability to learn. So
Indeed. I guess one of the key things is, yeah, kind of dyslexic. So like reading has never really been something that's enjoyable for me is probably the best way to describe it for people. So I kind of like literally read like 5 novels in my life, and trying to read a book from cover to cover is just a Herculean task. So that's kind of very much directed how I like to consume information. And that's probably kind of where I said I found like reading magazines a lot easier. Or books that I can dip in and out of. So I tend to go and read books at specific chapters for specific topics and stuff like that. And that's probably where I can consume probably a lot more stuff from, say, blog posts, or, you know, just going and reading certain pages of kind of manuals and things like that. And that's also probably where like learning from peers and talking with peers and kind of learning a lot more verbally has probably been kind of how I wanted to choose to consume content. So that was probably one of the great things about like why I kind of got so much value from going to conferences and things like that, because that kind of like chance to speak to people who are like the experts in that subject, or to go and listen to that kind of like distilled information that then points you in the direction to go and do like the painful research, is kind of like very valuable to me, or has been.
I know you also mentioned user groups before. You've yes. been pretty active in user groups, particularly in the UK. Is that right?
Yeah. So definitely on the like Linux user group side, I've been a member of like Wolverhampton Linux user group since like 2008. And you know, they also, you know, back in the day, they used to do a podcast called Linux Radio, which even had live shows and everything, and then kind of spun out to be like OggCamp. And that was always quite good as well. I mean, especially kind of back in that era, we used to do like probably monthly or quarterly talks and stuff. So I definitely remember doing a talk there about DNS and things. But it was also just like a really great chance to go and meet people and talk about things, and that kind of social side, and also that social kind of style of learning where, you know, could you know, we just used to meet up in the pub, but the ability to sit and chat with somebody who'd been like using Linux from pretty much, say, like the mid-90s and using it professionally, always had something to kind of share and teach and that you could learn from. And then you could also do that to the new people who join. And or just sometimes, you know, the ability to talk through a problem with different people, get different people's perspective on things, was kind of valuable and interesting. And especially as well, like those kind of like, because Postgres London used to do some meetup groups and it'd be nice to get it going again. And some of those sessions were much more just like, rather than having talks all the time, we just had like round table discussions around, you know, this particular starting point and kind of go from there. And there were definitely some interesting kind of topics and discussions where people had very different viewpoints. And sometimes like those different opinions gives you different kind of ways to perceive problems and understand them and kind of learn in that kind of that way as well.
What I love is that, you know, with your dyslexia and the fact that reading a book cover to cover isn't the effective way for you to consume information, is you've just found all these other ways to learn, like you said, from peers at conferences. Definitely. By doing, by being curious and poking at things and fiddling and, I don't know. I think it's a great story for anybody who has any obstacle in their way in their process of learning, or maybe they can't take the traditional approach. You're just proof that you don't need to take the traditional book learning approach, and that maybe
I think it's not definitely
even traditional. Maybe I shouldn't even call it that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of almost at the viewpoint that there's probably enough different ways of how people's minds work that there's no real concept of like what is normal, right? But yeah, I think the key thing is you have to find the style that works for you. And I've never been the kind of person that could go and sit in a library. Like, I find actually some of the most productive place for me is to be in the coffee shop where there's a bit more noise going on. And it's like weird. I can focus and concentrate much more in the coffee shop than I can in like a library or something like that. And you just have to kind of find what works for you and don't be afraid to kind of do and try that. And I'm also like, I've always been that like much more practical side of engineering as well. So I've always kind of liked like hacking something together, building something. And if you have a little problem to scratch an itch, you can learn so much more by having something that you're interested in doing and want to go and build than you could reading a book, to be honest. That's my kind of, one of my opinions would be, if you kind of have an app that you want to build, just go and build it. Because you will learn so much doing that that you couldn't have learned from a book. And, you know, that's where probably an awful lot of my kind of becoming an expert has actually come much more from doing things and trying things and also being open to admit, like, yeah, that didn't quite work out. I probably shouldn't have done it that way. Next time I'm going to do something slightly different. But if you kind of don't keep practicing and don't keep doing that kind of stuff, then I don't think you can ever not, you can never become an expert by just like reading something and having that kind of theoretical knowledge, especially in our kind of like field.
We've bought back and forth between building your Postgres expertise and how you became more and more expert and your involvement in conferences, user groups, events. But at some point you pivoted from just being an attendee and participant to being a speaker. And then you pivoted to helping to organize Postgres events in particular. And I'm curious how that happened. I know there's a story there.
Yeah, so I guess like submitting a talks to like Postgres was something that I kind of like, was sort of like natural because I'd done it quite a few times in like the Linux kind of groups I was in. So it always been like, you know, it'd be quite nice to go and speak at PG Day or PG Conf, and I must admit, like bits of it were like, oh well, I'll just submit an abstract, see what happens, and then I was quite surprised to get accepted, and then it was all like, okay, it's become a bit more real, and getting that first talk accepted was then it's probably a lot easier to try and, you know, think you can do it the second time around. And I think, to be fair, one of those hurdles was like that mental thing of like, well, I don't have anything interesting to say, and like, you know, I think it was really easy to fall into that mindset of like, oh, well, I'm not like a developer or committer of Postgres, therefore I can't be the most expert, or I can't know that thing in huge amounts of detail. And it's like, I think it was definitely Simon Riggs who told me that, look, even I have to go and read the manual page to know how to use that bit of SQL or something like that. And it's like very powerful to have somebody I admired greatly and had probably known for a few years at that point through like going to events and Postgres London and stuff. To actually kind of, you know, say that it's actually perfectly fine. Nobody's going to be an expert in everything. There's no weakness in admitting what you don't know. That was definitely a big hurdle to get over to kind of get into speaking a bit more. And yeah, because like, to be honest, like going and speaking at Postgres events can be feel a bit intimidating at times. It's like, you know, I've been heckled by, say, Dave Kramer and sort of, and things like that. And it's like, you know, there's these people in the audience who, and I, you know, I think I had Tom Lane in the audience one time for one of my talks. And it's like, this is somebody I admire greatly from like all of his replies on the list and things like that. And then actually like getting over the, well, what if he asks a question, I don't know how to answer it. And actually just, it's perfectly fine to say, I don't know that, you know, it's always that kind of like supportive environment to some extent of, well, if you don't know it, somebody else in that room probably does. So that was kind of like probably a big mental thing to get over, and to also know that there is kind of help and support out there in terms of just like the friendliness of the community. And then kind of segueing into like getting more involved organizing, Simon kind of asked me to be on the talk selection committee for Postgres London the first year after COVID. So it kind of, I'd spoken the previous year at the virtual event, and also in the physical event in like 2019. And so, yeah, it was kind of him that who invited me to kind of say, well, you know, would you help out on the talk selection? And it was like, yes, of course. And, you know, it was one of those things, like, it was actually quite powerful being asked to be involved. And that was definitely then a segue to trying to get a bit more involved in other things. And when Simon announced he was kind of stepping back from the community and handing over Postgres London to Dave back in Berlin in 2022, I kind of afterwards went up and, you know, and said, oh, you know, I'd be very much interested in trying to help out and get Postgres London going again and get PGDA UK going again and stuff like that. And it kind of grew from there a little bit. And then I've got more and more involved. I spent this weekend building the website for PGDA UK this year. And yeah, so it's also one of those things where sometimes you kind of forget with like open source communities, you kind of have to just step up and offer to help rather than be asked to help. And that was probably a little mental thing that I'm probably only just kind of getting to understand.
So in my brain, I'm realizing that you are one of many, many examples of people that Simon Riggs touched, right? Whose path in Postgres was influenced by his leadership. And
definitely.
I know there's so many people that we've heard from on all the places online and on calls who are still struggling to process, you know, what happened last week with his passing. And but I just think it's wonderful that he asked you to take on these roles and you're continuing to do it.
Yeah. And I remember especially like the, was it 2021, the kind of first physical Postgres, Postgres London then / PGDA UK. And Simon went to like me and Russell. It was like, I'm going to leave at halfway through the day because we're going to an Elton John concert. You'll be fine. Just get on with it type thing. And you know, to have the kind of trust in the kind of people he'd kind of got to help out, that we could just kind of finish and run the rest of the day was quite powerful, and probably a very good example of his leadership. And yeah, sadly going to be sorely missed. And yeah, definitely kind of, you know, we only kind of really met at events over the years, but he was definitely, you know, I think a very great technical leader of the project, and definitely responsible for an awful lot of the things that make Postgres what it is today, to be honest. And also just, I think one of the things I always found really impressive was he had like a very long plan and a vision. And I don't think there's often that many good leaders who know that they want to put this into release, you know, 9, this into release 9.1, and they've got like a strategy of where they're going, and he was very good at that.
Well, speaking of a long plan and a vision, his keynote talk, Simon Riggs's keynote talk at PGConf EU last December, which was in Prague, was titled The Next 20 Years, right? Definitely. So even though he was retired at that point and was no longer working at EDB in Second Quadrant, he made the effort to come, put in the prep, give that keynote. And I thought it was, and a lot of people had positive things to say about it. About the vision and the inspiration. So I'll make sure we drop that link into the chat as well. All right, so back to you, Chris. Before we wrap, there's a few more things we really wanted to cover. Are there any other resources, like conferences, docs, extensions, books, website, or things that you want to give a shout out to that you think would be useful to other people who are trying to skill up in Postgres? Any favorites?
Yeah, so I think I've already mentioned MonSQL. I think the other one that was really very good is Dimitri Fontaine's The Art of SQL, The Art of PostgreSQL, right? That's an extremely good book and good resource. Also, like, if you want to see, like, to some extent, the art of the possible with Bits, Vic Fearing's Advent of Code stuff is always kind of fun when he's doing that, and you know, a good demonstrator of you can actually solve an awful lot with just SQL. I think also, to be honest, like Planet Postgres, I find, you know, just go and find some Postgres people, follow them in whatever social media you use and they use, is a great way to kind of go and learn about different tips and things and to go and find out like a general buzz of what's going on. I kind of, you know, like definitely that kind of stuff has been fairly advantageous for me about, you know, like when somebody puts a blog post about UIDs and stuff like that, and you know, having those kind of like interesting kind of opinions at times is actually then a good driver for you to go and kind of test your internal understanding and also go and maybe learn a bit more. Also, I think, to be honest, the Postgres docs get a bit underrated, right? You know, they're some of the best documentation for open source projects out there. There's so much detail in there about low level stuff, about how to use this SQL, lots of good examples. And at times, right, if you more just need to know a feature exists, and then you can go and find the good documentation that's there. So yeah, I mean, definitely plus one on, you know, it's not like a RTFM, right? It's a use it and dip in and out of it as you need to and things like that.
Well, and I know that it's not necessarily easy to contribute to the docs from a procedural standpoint.
Yeah.
I think that there's huge appreciation. Like, if you see things that are wrong or unclear or ambiguous or do need fixing in the docs, people love it when you submit. You can do it on any docs page, right? When you submit a bug, basically. And they, of course, love contributions from anybody when it comes to docs. You don't have to be a Postgres developer to contribute to making the docs better.
Definitely right. And it's probably something I should do a bit more of now and then. But yeah, I mean, I do think, and also, like, there's documentation at so many different levels, right? Because you've got like the docs of how to use this SQL, you've got the docs of then how that kind of works under the hood, and then the docs of like how to administer it. And I think maybe at times, right, people just need to kind of think a little bit about what level they need to go and read and things like that in the actual docs.
So Elizabeth Christensen, I actually noticed her blog post from Planet Postgres, because I follow Planet Postgres on Twitter. I'm on all the platforms, right? Mastodon, Twitter, Threads, Discord, Telegram, blah, blah, blah. And she just published a blog post called Contributing to Postgres 101, A Beginner's Experience. And she walked through, like, something's missing from the docs, a patch idea, you know, how do I help fix this? I thought it was a very positive story, and one that kind of shines a light on, well, how would you do this if you wanted to? So I'll drop that link in too. Did you see it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I didn't actually see that one, but I'd definitely be interested in having a quick read.
Okay, cool. There, I dropped in the link. All right, well, before we wrap, are there any final thoughts? I mean, we didn't really get to dive into how you use analogies to help developers and users understand things about Postgres. Maybe someone has to go and attend one of your talks to benefit from your analogies.
Yeah, I'm never sure if I've been a great one for analogies either, right? And also, I think half the time you just kind of, if you make them up, you make them up on the spot to some extent. But yeah.
Okay, so I really, really appreciate you joining us today, Chris. This has been an awesome conversation. Pino, did you have any final questions before we wrap?
No, nothing. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Well, then this is a big thank you to Chris for joining. The next episode is going to be recorded live on Wednesday, May 1st at 10 a.m. PDT. I think we're all done with our time changes across the planet now. The guest will be Michael Christofides of PG Mustard. If you can go ahead and mark your calendar by going to aka.ms/path-to-cytoscon-ep15-cal. You can always get to past episodes of this podcast and get links to the podcast platforms at aka.ms/path-to-cytoscon, all one word. Transcripts are included on the episode pages for each and every episode on Transistor 2. Now, before we leave today, I have a big thank you that I also need to communicate to Pino DeCandia. Pino has been a host of Path to CytusCon since the very beginning, which was a year ago. And initially, this podcast was just going to be a two-episode pre-event for last year's CytusCon. And in the beginning, we thought, well, maybe we'll run an experiment and we'll continue the podcast recordings on Discord for a few more episodes after the CytusCon virtual event is behind us. But here we are a year later. Path to CytusCon is thriving. It's has really less and less of a connection to the original CytusCon event. And it's really just a great podcast for people who care about Postgres, I think. And it's been really wonderful to prepare and collaborate with you, Pino. And I appreciate all of our time together in the last year. I love your questions. I love your curiosity and even the timbre of your voice. So thank you. And we're going to miss you as a co-host.
Well, thank you, Claire, so much. I've learned so much from you and enjoyed listening to you as we co-host the podcast episodes. I definitely stepped out of my comfort zone in joining the podcast for the first two episodes and then for the year. And I looked back at the year and what a year it's been. We've had 14 episodes with 25 guests, if my count is correct, and just an awesome set of guests and people from diverse backgrounds, so located all over the world. And fascinating stories. And I really love this people aspect of the podcast and delving into how people started and as developers, as technologists, as Postgres community members. And that's what I'll take away from it that really cherish. And I look forward to being a listener on the podcast moving forward, and that's much more my comfort zone than being on the mic. But I want to thank you and the production team, Aaron, Ari, previously Carol, just for a great collaboration. It was fun, all the brainstorming, and the guests and the audience that make the live show so fun on Discord, with side conversations and all the comments and links. Thanks to everyone. It's been a wonderful experience.
Thank you, Pino. So before we leave, we also want to ask those of you who are still listening that if you've enjoyed this podcast, please give it a rating and please give it a review on your favorite podcast platform. Ratings and reviews absolutely help other people like you discover this show. And a big thank you to everybody on the chat who's been here live today and participating in the conversation, especially when Chris disappeared for a few minutes there. It was great to get your ideas about what we should chat about. So that's it. It's a wrap. Thank you. See you next month.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.